Let us lie in wait for the righteous man, because he professes to have knowledge of God and calls himself a child of the Lord. He became to us a reproof of our thoughts. The very sight of him is a burden to us, because his manner of life is unlike that of others, and his ways are strange. He calls the last end of the righteous happy, and boasts that God is his father. Let us see if his words are true, and let us test what will happen at the end of his life. For if the righteous man is God's son, he will help him, and will deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. Let us test him with insult and torture, that we may find out how gentle he is, and make trial of his forbearance. Let us condemn him to a shameful death, for according to what he says, he will be protected. Thus they reasoned, but they were led astray, for their wickedness blinded them, and they did not know the secret purposes of God, nor hope for the wages of holiness, nor discern the prize for blameless souls. For God created man for incorruption, and made him in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it. But the souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them. In the eyes of the foolish, they only seemed to have died, and their departure was thought to be an affliction, and their going from us to be their destruction, but they are at peace. End quote. This text plainly says that a son of God will be humiliated and killed, just as the righteous man is generally. But then, quote, the righteous man who had died will condemn the ungodly who are living, end quote. Wisdom of Solomon 4, verse 16. And, quote, then shall the just one with great assurance confront his oppressors. And, upon seeing this, they shall be shaken with dreadful fear and amazed, and they will say, this is he whom once we held as a laughingstock and as a type for mockery, fools that we were. His life we accounted madness, and his death dishonored. See how he is accounted among the sons of God, how his lot is with the saints. End quote. That's Wisdom of Solomon 5, verses 1 to 5. And so we see again that the Jews were already being influenced by lessons and texts like these before Christianity even got started. And we can plainly see how the values espoused here align perfectly with the Christian message about Jesus. Holding says the content of Wisdom of Solomon 2, quote, would imply that Jesus, if he were indeed just, ought to have been delivered from his punishment, end quote. But Holding is reading the words of the wicked and mistaking them as advice to the righteous, and consequently he misses the point of the text, that God will not deliver Jesus until the resurrection. Holding seems to think the text tells the reader that God will help him and deliver him from the hand of his enemies, but Wisdom of Solomon 2, verse 21 says those who claimed this were deceived, for their own wickedness had blinded them. Holding apparently misses the exact parallel with Mark 15, verses 29 to 32, which develops Psalms 22, verses 7 to 8, where the wicked yet again say they expect God to save his son and are yet again deceived into imagining this, blinded by their wickedness. Otherwise, it is certainly true, and I consistently concede the point throughout my critique, that Christians still had to offer some evidence that Jesus was the one raised. But the issue is whether they needed irrefutable evidence, and I find they did not, as I'll show more directly in chapters 7, 13, and 17, but also in chapters 4, 6, and 10 coming up. So there is a flaw in Holding's reasoning. Yes, a man who, out of the blue, was crucified and then declared God would not win many supporters. But this did not come out of the blue. Rather, a large number of people had been prepared by the Jewish scriptures to expect that someone would suffer a most humiliating execution at the hands of the wicked elite, despite his complete innocence, and that this person would be the chosen one of God, a son of God, who would receive the ultimate elevation in heavenly honor, soon to return and impose his revenge on the wicked and bring salvation to the faithful. The soil was prepared for exactly what the Christians came to preach. In fact, this preparation no doubt contributed significantly to why the first Christians came to believe this amazing claim about Jesus in the first place. The scriptures predicted that around that very time, an innocent man would be humiliated with execution and scorn, and this man, scripture plainly said, would be the Messiah. Jesus was supposedly an innocent man humiliated with execution and scorn. That would have made him a good candidate. Holding's argument requires that the evidence must be overwhelming, but in fact, by being crucified, Jesus would already fit the bill, so it would not take much to convince his followers that he was more than merely a candidate for the title of Christ. This is confirmed by the fact that scriptural demonstrations were one of the main modes of successful argument employed by the Christians, as I'll explain in chapter 13. Even to the extent that the Christians developed novel interpretations, the fact that they found such meaning in these revered oracles could and often did carry tremendous weight. The relevant point here is that prophetic preparation for a crucified Messiah made sure that preaching a crucified Messiah would not be a black mark, but a useful tactic, even a feather in Christianity's cap, among many Jews certainly, but also among some Jewish sympathizers who were already acquainted with and impressed by their scriptures, and even among some unprepared Gentiles. Throughout the ancient world, a great many people were awed by the oracles of the gods and sought prophecy at innumerable places around the empire. They were also well acquainted with the idea of finding predictions of current events in sacred scriptures. The Roman state consulted the Sibylline books, for example. Thus, to convert an unprepared Gentile merely required introducing him to the relevant texts and explaining how the story of Jesus confirms them. The fact that a humiliated, crucified man becoming a god, as all heavenly kings and sons of God were, was predicted by ancient sacred texts, would be a powerful argument in favor of belief. It's no accident that the Christians relied on that very argument. Conclusion. Holding's point here only works to explain why certain groups and individuals rejected Christianity. It does nothing to argue against conversions from among those groups who actually did accept Christianity. For those groups included many people who would not have found anything challenging in worshiping a crucified martyr like Jesus, and some would even have found this particularly attractive, fitting both pagan and Jewish precedents and conforming to their needs and desires within a corrupt world beyond their control. As a result, that Christianity began and succeeded by preaching a crucified God was not improbable at all, much less so improbable only a real resurrection could explain it. Chapter 2. Who would follow a man from Galilee? Two key problems. James Holding points out that the Greco-Roman world was rife with what we would call prejudices and stereotypes, and far more starkly than we are used to in our own society. That is correct, but not everyone shared the same prejudices. Thus, Holding makes a false generalization when he claims that Gentiles would not listen to Christians plugging a Jewish deity. We already know that many Gentiles flocked to Judaism even before Christians came along, either converting to it, supporting it, or holding it in high esteem. We also know that Christianity was most successful in its first 100 years within exactly those groups, diaspora Jews and their Gentile sympathizers. I'll say more about this in chapter 18. Once Christianity had saturated that market apparently as far as it could, though still winning a few converts outside it, it began de-Judaizing the religion in order to make it palatable to more Gentiles. We see this process begin in the early 2nd century, and some scholars claim to see it beginning already in the Gospels or even with Paul. This move had become increasingly necessary after the two failed Jewish wars against Rome in the 60s and 130s AD had lost the Jews a lot of their earlier support and sympathy. But either way, the tactic worked. Christians could then claim that old advantage of persuasion, the enemy of your enemy is your friend. And they could begin to make their religion more philosophical, more Hellenistic, and less Jewish, all the while claiming to have rendered Judaism obsolete. Thus, even when its Jewishness really did become a problem, Christianity quickly found a way to overcome that handicap. Of course, Holding is right that had Christianity remained obstinately Jewish, it would have failed, and as a matter of fact, the original Jewish sects of Christianity did fail. That's why the successful Christian movements became increasingly un-Jewish, and why the Western Christian tradition became responsible for perpetuating the enduring bugbear of anti-Semitism. Holding does appear to concede as much, arguing only that Christianity never should have expanded in the Gentile world much beyond the circle of those Gentiles who were already God-fearers. Of course, it didn't, that is, not much beyond, until later, once issues of evidence could no longer arise, and the successful sects began abandoning their Jewishness, even turning against Judaism. Even so, Christianity did make some early inroads into groups outside the category of Jews and their sympathizers, for the simple reason that Christianity made it easier to convert. A large deterrent against conversion to Judaism was its intense list of arduous social and personal restrictions and its requirement for an incredibly painful and rather dangerous procedure of bodily mutilation called circumcision, and that in a world with limited anesthetics and antiseptics. Once Paul had abandoned those requirements for entry, he had on his hands a sect of Judaism that was guaranteed to be more popular than any previous form of it. Thus, far from Christianity's increased success being impossible, it was guaranteed. This doesn't mean people flock to it in droves, but it does mean that the already significant inflow of Gentiles toward the Jewish religion was certain to become significantly greater for its Christian sect. A second factor Holding overlooks is what Paul was doing. Throughout his letters, the impression is clear that he wanted to create a community that would transcend racial and social prejudices and encompass everyone, essentially ending the unwelcome strife between Rome and God's people by finding a way to unite them in peace. This was to be a new Israel, a community that would realize a socialist utopia of brotherhood by its own efforts without violence or rebellion. It would be free of the meddling influence of, and manipulation by, the corrupt Sanhedrin, priesthood, and rabbinate, and the Greek and Roman powers that be, economic, political, or military. And it would certainly not be spoiled by the very institutions that Paul saw destroying society, such as distinctions of wealth, status, and race. Paul was a fanatic about this, and made heroic efforts to push this agenda by traveling and writing letters throughout the Roman world, putting out fires and strengthening communities. He sought every means of persuasion to realize his dream. Quote, "I become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some," end quote. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 19 to 23, and 1 Corinthians 10, verse 33. Is it really so surprising that he would succeed at this? Certainly he didn't win over the world, but he was selling a very beautiful and attractive idea, and he clearly had the skills and education to package it in whatever way any given audience would find most persuasive. I think every scholar today would agree that had there been no Paul, there would have been no Christianity as we know it. His role in rescuing Christianity from failure cannot be overlooked. If anyone could sell this new Judaism light to the Gentiles, it was him. Getting the context right. So not only did Christianity abandon, almost from the start, most of the things Gentiles found distasteful about Judaism, but it benefited from one of the most industrious and skillful salesmen the ancient world ever saw. That put Christianity in at least the same standing in terms of potential success as almost every other ancient cult. Holding claims that the Romans naturally considered their own belief systems to be superior to all others, yet the Romans were famous for accepting into their society literally every single foreign religion that crossed their doorstep. From the castrated priesthood of Attis, to the cosmopolitan Egyptian cult of Isis, to the Syrian sun cult of Emperor Elagabalus, and beyond. The examples are countless. The castrated priesthood of Attis was formally set up in the capital city of Rome by the government itself. The cosmopolitan Egyptian cult of Isis won the esteem of the otherwise maligned Emperor Caligula and became the number one mystery religion among the Roman elite in the 2nd century, and is well attested as far off as even the cities of Roman Britain. The Syrian sun cult of Emperor Elagabalus was formally established in Rome even before his reign, and during his reign briefly became the official state cult. The Phrygian Mithras won the hearts of many among the legionary elite. The Greco-Chaldean theology of Neoplatonism won the minds of many of the later Roman intelligentsia. The backwater Black Sea cult of Alexander of Abunoticus won the favor of emperors and governors. Even Judaism is an example, and so on. Sure, there were intellectuals like Seneca who were horrified by all this, or who, like Plutarch, sought to alter these foreign traditions to be more palatable, more philosophical. Yet they could not stem the tide of elites and commoners who embraced all these diverse foreign religions all over the Roman Empire. As far as foreign cults go, Christianity had stepped into a seller's market. It is true, as Holding suggests, that Christianity was much like a 1960s-style countercultural movement, but that was its appeal. The Christian missionaries were meeting a new market demand of a growing mass of the discontented. They were not successful with those well served by the social system. They were successful with those who were sick of that system, disgusted with it, and yet powerless to do anything about it. And observe how successful the 60s movement was, despite launching into full flower right on the wings of the most rabidly conservative McCarthy era, and facing violent opposition from every quarter. Christianity wasn't nearly that disruptive. The Christians organized no mass protests, engaged in no civil violence, dodged no drafts, and paid their taxes. Indeed, they didn't even advocate breaking any laws whatsoever, but submitting fully to all the authorities. Just see Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, and I'll discuss more about this in chapter 10. As to other elements of stigma that might have dissuaded converts, we shall discuss those later. But as far as the government was concerned, there was no real threat from Christians, and as a result, persecution during its first 100 years, especially from the government, was unusual and typically unexpected. I'll talk about this in chapter 8, but the attitude of Gallio in Acts 18, verses 12 to 16, was typical. For now, it's enough to note that there was nothing inherently shocking about Christianity when compared with all the other strange foreign cults that flourished at the time, which included numerous sects of Jews who found their own Gentile converts or supporters. A working-class rabbi. So there was nothing about being Jewish that prevented Christianity from achieving the small success it did in its first 100 years. But Holding offers a few other stigmas, which he claims would have handicapped it, besides still more that he assigns entire sections to, which I'll deal with in later chapters. He rightly notes that many among the snobbish elite looked down their noses at working-class occupations like carpentry, and Jesus was a carpenter, which may be a reason why Christianity won little support from the elite quarter. But other groups did not share this low opinion, and they were the ones the early Christians successfully evangelized. The working class, the poor, those who resented the rich and powerful, and, again, Jews and their sympathizers. Jews greatly admired tradesmen, and usually expected their rabbis to master a trade. The greatest and most revered rabbis of the period had practical trades. Hillel was a woodcutter, Shammai a carpenter. This was typical throughout the great rabbinical tradition. Yehuda was a mechanic, Yose a tanner, and Yochanan the sandaler was, as one can tell from his name, a sandal maker. Their trades are evident even in the tales told of them. For example, in the Talmud, Hillel drives someone off with a builder's cubit he happened to have in his hand. Paul himself was a tent maker, according to Acts 18, verse 3. Does it sound like these people or their admirers would scorn the idea of revering a carpenter? Not at all. In the Mishnah, Rabbi Gamaliel said, "Fitting is learning the Torah along with the craft, for the labor put into the two of them makes one forget sin." Indeed, he says, "All learning of Torah, which is not joined with labor, is destined to be null and cause sin." Rabbi Yehuda said, "Whoever does not teach his son a trade teaches him robbery," a proverb almost identically embraced by pagans, as expressed by a leading Platonist, "If a man will not dig or knows no other profit-earning trade, he is clearly minded to live by stealing or robbery or begging." Rabbi Shemaiah even said we should love work. Indeed, his complete declaration is more revealing. Quote, "Love work, hate authority, don't get friendly with the government," end quote. This expresses the attitude of exactly those for whom Christianity was most attractive. Another example of this resentment of the elite appears in Rabbi Yehuda's declaration that even the best among physicians is going to hell. The Christian tale of the woman who bled for 12 years reveals a similar criticism of doctors in Luke 8, verse 43. We might even see this attitude in the prominent disdain held for, quote-unquote, the scribes as a group throughout the Gospels. This may have been a jab at men who claimed authority in the law, yet didn't hold what was considered a real working-class job. In addition to all that, every member of Essene communities was expected to ply a manual trade. This was part of its anti-elitist vision and one of the very reasons people joined it. And of Jewish sects, Christianity resembles the Essenes more than any other, both in its moral ideals and its consistently anti-elitist rhetoric. Christianity in the first century was most successful among Jews as well as Gentiles who shared or were sympathetic to Jewish values. But what about outside those groups? There, Christianity was most successful among the middle and lower classes, especially targeting craftsmen and other middlemen whom the aristocracy often scorned. I'll mention more about this in chapter 18. Obviously, tradesmen, middlemen, and the lower classes didn't look down their noses at themselves. I'll say more about that in chapter 12. In other words, outside the arena of Jewish values, Christianity was most successful among those who would not have looked down on a carpenter, while it was least successful among those who did. Therefore, Holding's argument is irrelevant to what actually happened. If logic is not enough to prove that pagan tradesmen held their own class in high esteem, we have evidence. In Lucian's account of his education in his essay My Dream, he explains how his family sought to improve his prospects by buying him an apprenticeship to a stonecutter, after considering several other trades, in the course of which all his friends and family argued for the value and respectability of becoming a craftsman. Tradition before the time of Christ also held that Socrates, the greatest and most admired philosopher of the ancient world, was the son of a stoneworker and a stoneworker himself. He was also, incidentally, a convicted criminal executed by the state. We also have countless examples of Greek and Roman tradesmen boasting of their jobs in inscriptions and reliefs carved on their homes and tombstones, and of trade guilds boasting in public inscriptions of their recognition, membership, or accomplishments. Clearly, there had to be a substantial segment of the population that thought well of such achievements. I photographed an example myself when I visited the British Museum. The relief I took a photo of depicts two brothers celebrating their achievement of freedom. The symbols of their manumission from slavery are shown on the left-hand side of this inscription, as well as their professions. The tools of a smith or minter are depicted above their heads, and the tools of a carpenter to the right. They were clearly proud of their trades and went to considerable expense to boast of them. They would not have bothered if no one was going to admire them for it. Therefore, the profession of Jesus would not have been a major barrier to conversion. To the contrary, among those the Christians actually evangelized, it was often an asset, and for some Jews, it would have been a requirement. Nor was it thought odd to worship a god who held a lower-class occupation. Hephaestus was a blacksmith, Orpheus a musician, Pollux a boxer, and Romulus was a shepherd, while some gods were humiliated by being sent to earth to be enslaved by human masters. Hence Apollo became a shepherd and Poseidon a bricklayer. Yet this did not diminish the worship of any of these deities. As even the Christian author Arnobius admits of his pagan peers, quote, "You represent to us the gods, some as carpenters, some physicians, others working in wool, as sailors, players on the harp and flute, hunters, shepherds, and, beyond that, mere rustics," end quote. Obviously, throwing another carpenter into the mix would hardly make a difference. This provides a particular example of J.P. Holding's incompetence, or dishonesty, as a scholar. In my original refutation, I only bothered to demonstrate, and conclusively, that Jews had great respect for tradesmen and thus would not have looked down on Jesus for being a carpenter, as Holding had falsely claimed. How did Holding respond to being so soundly refuted? By inventing the bizarre claim that only Jews respected tradesmen, apparently assuming that Greco-Roman tradesmen all despised themselves and each other, which is obviously ridiculous. Yet he clearly just made this up without even bothering to check if it was true. This is typical of Holding's methods, not actually checking the facts before making a claim. Indeed, he betrayed his remarkable ignorance of ancient culture by saying, quote, "The only evidence anyone can find is within Judaism," end quote. Only someone who knew nothing about the ancient world and made no effort to learn would make so foolish a claim as that. In a similar fashion, Holding declared no one would worship a deity who worked in a lower class occupation, which is also not true. As just noted, the pagans worshipped several gods of that description. Consequently, I significantly updated my refutation to include all the evidence Holding embarrassingly claimed didn't exist, including that photograph of those working class brothers I took. I digress on this point merely to emphasize how unreliable and, in my opinion, dishonest some Christian scholars are, and how little J.P. Holding should ever be trusted in anything he claims about antiquity. Another example of his desperate tactic of making things up in order to pretend he hasn't been refuted is Holding's subsequently more adamant claim that no one in antiquity had notions of improving their condition. That is equally outrageous. It is not what any of the scholars he quotes to that effect have ever argued. To the contrary, they would all be appalled by what he claims they said. So you shouldn't trust Holding. Instead, you should actually buy or borrow the books he quotes and read them yourself. Then you will see how those scholars actually discuss the total situation very differently than Holding lets on. On this issue in particular, the evidence is overwhelmingly against him, as I will explain in Chapter 10, where I also present examples of his gross misrepresentation of the arguments of the scholar Bruce Molina. But we needn't survey the opinions of scholars. We can go to the primary evidence. And here, Lucian's autobiographical account in his speech, My Dream, again provides refutation enough. There he explains how his family sought to improve his prospects by buying him an apprenticeship to a stonecutter, and how Lucian in turn regarded it as far better an improvement in his situation to become a scholar instead. Yet according to Holding, no one in antiquity thought or acted like this. Holding simply isn't telling the truth. To illustrate further, Holding claims that the ancient idea of quote-unquote limited good entailed that everyone would hate Christians for taking what wasn't theirs, and no one would join Christianity for the purpose of improving their access to goods, like food, friendship, or healthcare. Holding is simply wrong. And, of course, none of the sources he cites say any such thing about Christianity. They only discuss the idea of limited good as a social problem that Christianity was a response to, not as a barrier to Christianity's success. In contrast, Holding argues, quote, "Just as anachronistic is Carrier's idea that Christian missionaries were meeting a new market demand of a growing mass of the discontented, he is yet again importing modernist individualist ideas into the social world of the New Testament. The reality, however, is that discontent, such as he imagines, though it would exist, would not be seen as solved by Christianity, as Pilch and Molina report in the Handbook of Biblical Social Values, page 79 forward, this was a world of limited good within which all resources were considered at a fixed value. The discontented, who wished to rise in the ranks, would perceive that they did so at the expense of others, including their fellow poor, who would have the same perception and would resent any attempt to rise above others. Thus, in fact, the ancient person regarded their lot as decided by fate. However dissatisfied they may have been, there was nothing that they could do about it, and any discontented person seeking resolution of the sort Carrier envisages would incur the envy and probation of their fellow in-group members. If anything, Christianity as a newcomer would be rejected as a religion trying to cut from the pie that was already distributed." End quote. I personally asked Bruce Molina about this, and he told me himself that this is not what he argued. Instead, Molina says, quote, "Morality based on limited good held people back, except those devoted to greed," end quote. Hence, quote, "the commonplace, every rich person was a thief or the heir of a thief," end quote. And for this reason, Christianity was attractive, not stigmatized, because it sought to restore the distribution of goods according to human dignity as intended by God, rather than according to the cutthroat principles of the wider society. "I have argued," Molina wrote, "that what people wished to do was to maintain the status that they believed was proper to their kin group, and this often entailed improving their circumstances when they were dislodged from their status. Hence the poor were poor because of the immoral greed of the rich, not because of mere fate. To the contrary, the very idea of limited good Molina argues for would have caused the poor to feel cheated, and then motivated them to seek to restore the piece of the pie that was already owed them, and promised them by God. As Molina told me, he thought Jews would have seen in Christianity an effort to realize God's law as established in Leviticus 25, verses 10 to 55. Christianity was thus a movement widely seen as seeking to set things right, not as an attempt to rise above others. So nothing I argued was anachronistic, as Holding claimed, but was in fact perfectly in accord with the social reality of the ancient world. As Molina himself says, the ancients did believe they could do something about their lot. Christianity was seen by many as a solution to the inequities of society, and its efforts to restore equity were not resented by anyone but the greedy, thieving rich. Holding thus misrepresents what his own sources say in order to declare as fact the exact opposite of what they said. I have a hard time seeing that as anything but dishonest. The bottom line is, there was nothing improbable about a working-class God being worshipped, especially by working-class people. Hence, this was no barrier to Christianity's success. To the contrary, it was an asset among those it successfully recruited, who saw in Christianity a way to answer one of their most nagging complaints about the world, its widespread social and economic injustice. That this was part of what made Christianity attractive and thus successful among those who converted in its early decades of evangelism will become evident here and in subsequent chapters. Holding attempted to challenge this by strangely asking what kerygma, gospel message, I imagine the Christian missionaries taught, even though I explicitly discuss this in several places, and never do I mention quote-unquote justice and contentment in those contexts. He apparently means to argue against the fact that Christianity was attractive because it was a movement of moral and social justice by somehow mistaking the reason it was attractive with the actual way it was sold. I never make that mistake myself. I consistently argue that the Christian kerygma was from the very beginning exactly as Holding wants it to be, that Christ died for our sins and rose again, and all who join him will be saved. The question my critique here sets out to answer is why anyone believed this message, and I certainly find, along with many other scholars, even those Holding himself cites, that the moral and material benefits of membership were among those reasons, as following chapters will explain. The question of why the first Christians sought to attach this moral message to that kerygma is a question whose answer has little bearing on Holding's thesis, since his argument concerns why the message would sell, not where it came from or how it was packaged. Just as modern advertisers sell their products with sex or appeals to popular values, the Christians sold their gospel by attaching it to moral and social values they believed were popular among those social groups they didn't already despise. The Galilean Connection. The most important stigma Holding brings up in this context, since he names an entire section after it, is the fact that Jesus came from the Idaho of Judea, the most hick and bumpkin county of Galilee. He summarizes the point very well, worth quoting in full. Quote, "Christianity had a serious handicap, the stigma of a savior who undeniably hailed from Galilee, for the Romans and Gentiles, not only a Jewish land, but a hotbed of political sedition. For the Jews, not as bad as Samaria, of course, but a land of yokels and farmers without much respect for the Torah, and worst of all, a savior from a puny village of no account, in other words, Nazareth. Not even a birth in Bethlehem, or Matthew's suggestion that an origin in Galilee was prophetically ordained, would have unattached such a stigma. Indeed, Jews would not be convinced of this, even as today, unless something else first convinced them that Jesus was divine or the Messiah." End quote. Of course, even by the Christians' own inflated numbers in Acts, few Palestinian Jews were convinced. I'll talk about that in chapter 18. But besides that, hasty generalizations abound here. Yes, most of the Jewish elite, especially snobs, most notably those who would feel threatened by the popularity of any outsider, Galilean or not, gaining moral authority among the people, would balk and snipe at the origins of Jesus. And yes, maybe some Jews would snobbishly or naively expect a Messiah to hail from a famous city, just as they expected him to hail from royal blood, and the Christians did struggle to assert just such a claim for Jesus. But most of those receiving Paul's mission would have had neither prejudice. Among Gentiles, most by far would know nothing of a past Galilean rebellion, nor would a rebellion be any stigma for those who disliked the Roman order. Among diaspora Jews, Galilee was nevertheless part of the Holy Land of Israel, and that was always more prestigious than not. In fact, along with Essenes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and a dozen or more others, there was a distinct sect of rabbis that originated and held authority in Galilee. Holding's premise that seditious lands produced a stigma is also questionable. Italy rebelled against Rome barely a century before, in the Social War of 90 BC. And Asia Minor followed soon after that in the Mithridatic Wars of the 80s. Yet neither territory was stigmatized for it. So why should Galilee have been? There is no evidence it was. Nor was Galilee such a disrespected hick region as some have claimed. Apart from the disagreements between Galileans and Pharisees attested in the Talmud, which were no more derisive than those between Pharisees and Sadducees, within the first 100 years of the Christian mission, we have no actual criticism or disdain for the region of Galilee from any source except the Gospel of John. So also for Nazareth, which was not the tiny hovel it's often made out to be. A Jewish inscription from the 2nd or 3rd century confirms that Nazareth was one of the towns that took in Jewish priests after the destruction of the temple in 66 AD. Would priests deign to shack up in a despised hick town? And archaeology confirms it may have had a significant stone building before then, perhaps the synagogue claimed to be there in Luke 4, verse 16. Nazareth definitely had grain silos, cisterns, ritual immersion pools, smartly cut cave dwellings and storerooms, a stone well, and a significant necropolis, also cut from the rock of Nazareth's hill, all in the time of Jesus. This was no mere hamlet, but a village inhabited by hundreds experiencing significant economic success. For example, four calcite column bases were recovered at Nazareth, which were reused in a later structure, but are themselves dated before the Jewish War of 60 to 70 AD, by their stylistic similarity to Roman and synagogue structures throughout first century Judea, and by the fact that they contain Nabataean lettering, which suggests construction before Jewish priests migrated to Nazareth after the war, as well as their cheap material, calcite instead of marble. Aramaic-inscribed marble fragments have also been found there, paleographically dated around the end of the 1st century or early 2nd century, demonstrating that Nazareth had marble structures near the time the Gospels were written, even if not before. Otherwise, very little of Nazareth has been excavated, and therefore no argument can be advanced regarding what wasn't there in the 1st century. All the more so, since evidence suggests any stones and bricks used in 1st century buildings in Nazareth were reused in later structures, thus erasing much of the evidence. There simply isn't any case to be made that it was a despised or insignificant hovel. In contrast, the Gospel of John is alone in having anyone declare anything like the concern of Nathanael. Quote, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" End quote. John 1, verse 46. Yet Nathanael is not mentioned in any other gospel, nor in Acts, so he was either not a real person or not a very important one in Christian memory. And yet, even according to John, this lone snob is converted after a single conversation with Jesus, while Jesus still lived, and not by any evidence of his resurrection after he died. Just read John 1, verses 47 to 49. Since the only man on record scorning a Nazarene origin was still open to the possibility that Jesus was the Christ, and then fairly easily convinced of it, it follows that hailing from Nazareth was no great barrier to conversion, nor was anything like evidence of his resurrection required to overcome that barrier. Likewise, though Josephus mentions Galilee a total of 158 times in his entire opus, not a single mention contains any hint that the region was looked down upon in the Roman period. In fact, it was the recipient of great honors under Herod. He lavished building projects on Sepphoris, the security of all Galilee, which received the coveted and prestigious status of metropolis, and he chose to build the great city of Tiberias there in the very lifetime of Jesus. Herod would not insult Emperor Tiberius by choosing to build and name a new city after him in a scorned backwater. Josephus also reports that Galilee had 240 cities and villages, and was renowned for its prodigious oil production, and the governorship of Galilee was highly coveted. For a time, Josephus was governor of the Galilee himself, and he certainly appears to have been proud of it. Even the respected Jewish sage and scholar Eliezer the Galilean came from there. Indeed, the very fact that there was a Galilean scholar famous enough for us to know of him proves Galilee was no hick backwater. Eliezer was also famous for converting the Gentile king Izates to Judaism during the reign of Claudius, exactly when Paul was preaching Christ. So hailing from Galilee did not turn off even well-informed kings. Finally, Josephus records that, combined with Perea, Galilee produced 200 talents in tribute a year, a substantial sum, nearly 6 tons of silver or gold. And most of that came from Galilee. In fact, measured in terms of wealth and number of major cities, Perea was far more a hick backwater than Galilee. When Herod Antipas received Galilee and Perea as his tetrarchy, he lived and set up his administration in Galilee, thus demonstrating its greater prestige. And when he held a birthday banquet for himself, it was the leading men of Galilee who were invited. We hear no mention of leading men of Perea. Just read Mark 6, verse 21. And yet, the revered John the Baptist hailed from and preached in Perea. So coming from a hick backwater was clearly no barrier to prestige or respect. The Gospel of John. So why is the Gospel of John the only source we have from the period that denigrates Galilee? Probably for exactly the opposite reason Holding thinks. John included that material deliberately to exploit the disdain people have for elite snobbery. By playing up the snobbish rejection of any message from Galilee or any prophet from a small rural town, John is playing on popular disdain for exactly such attitudes. His audience would see the Jewish elite in this story the same way someone from a small, wholesome town in upstate New York sees Manhattanite snobs who despise anyone not from the Big Apple. Indeed, the Republican Party in the United States often plays the, quote, small town of mom and apple pie, end quote, against the, quote, decadent New York elite, end quote, in exactly the same way John does. See how they look down their noses at you. Don't you hate that? So don't follow them, follow us. We're the party of the common man, of true family values against the hypocrisy and corruption of the big city snobs. That message resonated even more strongly then than it does today. And yet the same rhetoric still works today. It would have worked even better then. Christianity was originally a movement for the poor and the disgruntled middle class. It preached to the very people who despised the Jerusalemite snobbery that John went out of his way to depict. So representing the Jerusalem elite as despising the origins of Jesus actually helped the gospel. It didn't hurt it. Having a hero from a small town would be a big sell. It held out an alternative to elite snobbery, a hero just like the average man, who, just like the average man, suffered under the heel of these big town jerks. This is clear from the way John uses this material, repeated in no other gospel. Nor are any of the key characters ever mentioned in any other source, not even Acts. Consider John 7, verses 41 to 52. Quote, "Some said, 'This is the Christ.' But others said, 'What? Does the Christ come out of Galilee? Doesn't Scripture say the Christ will come from the seed of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was?' So there arose a division in the multitude because of him, and some of them would have seized him, but no man laid hands on him." End quote. Already John is saying that though some rejected Jesus on these snobbish grounds, many were not dissuaded by that fact. Enough, in fact, to create a division and prevent the Jewish officials from seizing Jesus. So the argument was not that effective against accepting Jesus. And John's audience is meant to sympathize with those people who rejected this elitist argument. This is clear from the way the story continues. Quote, "The officers, therefore, came to the chief priests and Pharisees, but they said to them, 'Why did you not bring him?' The officers answered, 'No one told us to.' The Pharisees therefore answered them, 'Are you also led astray? Have any of the rulers believed in him, or of the Pharisees? But only this multitude that doesn't know the law and are accursed.'" End quote. In other words, John is using the fact that the elite, the rulers, and the Pharisees rejected the message of Christianity as a point in its favor, which means it must also have been true. John was in effect arguing to the reader, "You common folk, see how they denigrate you and say you are ignorant and accursed?" Thus, John attests not only to the fact that it's the non-elites who are converting to Christianity, not the snobs whom Holding quotes, but also the fact that this was the very reason they were converting. They despised attitudes like that of the Pharisees depicted here, and John is using that anger as a means to persuade them of the merits of the Christian message. This is proven by the speech that John now includes in this narrative, in the mouth of Nicodemus, a Pharisee that John alone portrays as gradually coming over to Jesus' side in John 3, verse 1 to 9, John 7, verse 51, and John 19, verse 39. Quote, "Nicodemus, who came to Jesus before and was now one of his followers, said to them, 'Does our law judge a man before it first hears from him and knows what he does?' They answered and said to him, 'Are you also from Galilee? Search and see that out of Galilee no prophet arises.'" End quote. Nicodemus thus champions the enlightened ideal of justice against the very corrupting prejudice the Pharisees are expressing here. We see this in the writings of Seneca, the famous line, "He who decides a case without hearing the other side, even if he decides justly, cannot be considered just." To understand how a reader of John would react to this passage, think of it in a modern context. The snob says, "He's from Idaho. No great scholar has ever come from Idaho." Righteous man: "What, are we going to judge him before we even know what he's actually said and done?" Snob: "You must be from Idaho." The insulting fallacy of responding to a valid call for the just and equal treatment of everyone by accusing the one who makes that call of being a hick themselves is exactly the sort of thing that enraged the lower classes back then, as it does today. John is getting the audience on his side and turning them against the Jewish elite. We'll examine this class conflict further in chapter 12. So the fact that Jesus hailed from Galilee was no barrier to Christian success. On the contrary, among those who actually did convert, it would have been either irrelevant or an actual asset, considering Galilee was not really so scorned a place, but especially considering how authors like John exploited so effectively what scorn there was, using the very prejudice Holding points to as a weapon in Christianity's favor. Indeed, the entire Gospel of John is crafted to appeal to that universal human tendency toward reactionary anti-elitism, described so well by Richard Hofstadter in the context of modern America, though in that case with different social causes. Accordingly, Richard Rohrbaugh concludes from a survey of scholarship on John, quote, "John is almost certainly a Galilean gospel, aimed at a group which exists within a dominant society, but as a conscious alternative to it, in particular an alienated group which had been pushed or withdrawn to the social margins where it stood as a protest to the values of the larger society," end quote. That's the very target audience who would side with Nicodemus, not the other Pharisees. Holding's argument would be correct for many Pharisees, but not for those who shared the view expressed by Nicodemus. And those were the people Christianity successfully evangelized, far more successfully than the Jewish elite, as even the Gospel of John admits. To be more correct, it wasn't necessarily the actual values of the wider society that Christians set themselves against, but the actual or perceived corruption of those values by the elite and their supporters, as I'll argue in chapter 10. That there was a major conflict of values and expectations between the upper and lower classes, as I've been arguing, is obvious to any expert in Roman history and is now the consensus view. Of course, instead of open rebellion in this case, there is a mode of resistance which may take the form of passive symbiosis, which is exactly what the Christian church did. Clearly, snobbery against the Galilean or Nazarene origins of Jesus would, at worst, have had no effect on the actual success Christianity experienced in its first century of growth, and at best would even have improved that success by making it more attractive to a much larger segment of the population, rather than less so. Holding steps into a trap. What I've said on the status of Nazareth and Galilee remains unrefuted. Nevertheless, Holding tried to defend his unsupported assertions by twisting what I said with even more unsupported assertions and adding groundless insults against my competence, all the while ignoring the actual point, that there is no evidence whatsoever of any prejudice or disdain toward Galilee or Nazareth except a single remark in the Christian Gospel of John, which is cunningly used to denounce such prejudice as a conceit of the arrogant elite. Everything I said on that subject stands, but examining how Holding tries to skirt this issue with bluff and innuendo provides a good example of his typical and arguably dishonest tactics. First, as to priests moving to Nazareth within 30 years of the time of Christ, Holding tries to dismiss this as an inscription 100 years too late, even though it documents an event only 30 years after the time of Christ. Holding then tries to dismiss it by claiming, "It is clear that prejudices would at times have to take a backseat to practicality," even though this makes no sense in this case, for there were numerous major cities in Galilee and elsewhere in Judea outside Galilee where priests could have gone. So there was no practical necessity here. Why would they even think of moving to Nazareth? Clearly they had no prejudice against it. His offered idea that they went there to teach the Nazarenes is completely an invention of Holding's imagination, and yet even if it were true, it would only prove my point. They clearly thought well enough of the Nazarenes to honor them with their time, attention, education, and even their residence. And this is no small matter for Holding, for it entails that they thought it fitting to join the group. Holding argues ad nauseum that to know a person's home was to know them, which if true would entail that no priest would dare become a Nazarene, for then all the stigma attached to Nazarenes would attach to them. Holding thus traps himself in a catch-22 from which there is no escape. No matter how you spin it, there could not have been any great stigma attached to becoming a Nazarene. Holding also claims I'm confused if I suppose that Major stone structures somehow lifted the social status of Nazareth in the eyes of outsiders. But all he has to back up this claim is a ridiculous analogy from modern times, even though Holding otherwise constantly berates me for imposing modern ideas on past cultures. So it seems he's the one who is confused. I don't really do what he accuses me of, but he does. No surprise there. The fact remains that no town would have major stone structures in the ancient world unless it possessed or received some wealth, and that entailed some measure of status. True, it was no Sepphoris or Tiberias, but it was no despised hick town either, and Holding is still wrong to claim so. And that's the bottom line. Holding cannot present any evidence that Nazareth was despised by ordinary people. John gives us the only hint of prejudice at all, and that only from the elite, a prejudice John's narrative condemns. And for Galilee, we find no hint of this prejudice in Josephus, who was himself an elite and who wrote about Galilee extensively, yet never once do we hear anything about anyone's disdain for it. Clearly, if there was any such disdain, it was not common enough to remark upon, and Josephus himself did not share it. Holding then steps into a trap. He responded by saying that, quote-unquote, line 390 in the life of Josephus, which I originally cited, contains nothing about what I argue, that in line 228, nothing is said about the governorship of Galilee, and that Jewish War 2, paragraph 590, refers only to the repairing of a wall. From all of this, Holding mistakenly claims that, quote, Carrier clearly hopes that no one will check these references, end quote. Yet in saying this, Holding proves he is not a skilled researcher and has no competent knowledge of the sources he is working with. The fact is, I made a small mistake in writing down the numbers of my source citations in that one endnote, which I then corrected. But the error was so small that had Holding actually read the paragraph, not the line, in each case, he would have seen that the material I referred to is there. The fact that he didn't do so simple a check as this proves that Holding is just mining his sources and doing the absolute minimum to prove his case instead of honestly and seriously studying the sources and making sure his claims are correct. Holding doesn't read Josephus. He just jumps to single sentences that help his case, not even caring if there are any other sentences that hurt his case. And while I knew these facts and then took the trouble of tracking down the exact references, Holding is completely ignorant of the facts and therefore incapable of tracking them down. Instead, he just uses what he wants and ignores the rest. The truth be damned. In fact, the truth is apparently so irrelevant to J.P. Holding that when he can't find facts to help him, he just makes them up, as we've already seen before. His dismissal of my Eliezer the Galilean example is another case. He tries to discredit this example by asserting that, in order to become a scholar, he had to leave Galilee and be tutored, very likely in the prestigious city of Jerusalem. Now, there is no basis whatever for this claim. Holding just made it up, out of the blue. How does Holding know there were no schools in Galilee? He doesn't. He just asserts it. Since the sources say there was a sect of rabbis called the Galileans, who were often at odds with the Jerusalem rabbis, it is simply incredible to think that these Galileans went to schools in Jerusalem. And even if you think it plausible, there is still no evidence that any of them did, and no evidence that Eliezer did, or even would have. But J.P. Holding can't be wrong, so he gets to make up any facts he wants to secure his case. That isn't the only dirty tactic Holding employs. He also moves the goalposts. For example, Holding also claims Eliezer is irrelevant because, quote, no one was ever asked to worship this man, end quote. But that has nothing to do with the fact that Holding claimed a Galilean would be looked down upon and never revered. Eliezer refutes that very prediction, therefore the prediction is false. Instead of admitting that I refuted his claim, he pretends he made a completely different claim. The fact is, whether anyone would worship Eliezer would depend on other factors apart from his origin. In other words, where someone came from didn't matter, so long as there were reasons to worship him. Holding can't challenge that conclusion, so he tries to pretend it doesn't affect his case. But it does. Holding is the one who claimed there was an insurmountable prejudice against Galileans. I proved him wrong. So now he pretends his now-refuted argument didn't matter. Maybe it doesn't, but it was still wrong, and therefore no longer supports his case. The role of messianic prophecy. At the same time, an origin in both Galilee and Nazareth was exploited by some Christian evangelists in another way, as confirming that Jesus was the Christ. This is the tactic employed by Matthew, who tells us that the Christ had to come from Nazareth, that what was spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled, that he shall be called a Nazarene, Matthew 2, verse 23. Although no such prophecy can be found in the extant text of the Bible, there was no canon at the time, and we don't know what texts Matthew's audience may have relied on or how they interpreted them. Some scholars think Matthew may have meant the prophecies that the Messiah would be rejected, as we've talked about in chapter 1, in which case Matthew's tactic is identical to John's, exploiting the lowly origins of Jesus as a rhetorical advantage. Matthew also claims, even more credibly, that prophecy predicted a Messiah who would come from Galilee of the Gentiles, a land that was previously held in contempt but later made glorious. This we see in Isaiah 9, verse 1. And that he would preach out of the Galilean city of Capernaum, as in fact all the Gospels depict him doing. Yet Capernaum is among the least prestigious cities of Galilee, so prophecy did not anticipate a Messiah from a prestigious city, undermining Holding's premise that everyone would expect such an origin. Against this point, Holding argues that the Christians could still claim this prophetic Galilee connection and yet place the birth of Jesus in Sepphoris or even Capernaum for the prestige it afforded rather than Nazareth. But such a conjecture carries little weight. First, there is no reason anyone had to expect the Messiah would come from anywhere but, at most, Bethlehem. And the only sources we have on Jesus' place of birth make every effort to place it precisely there. We see this in John 7, verse 41 to 42, Matthew 2, verse 1, Luke 2, verse 1 to 7. The prophetic anticipation of a Messiah from Capernaum does not specify birth, but the light of glory, and accordingly, all the Gospels place the origin of the Gospel there. Second, as we've seen here and in chapter 1, all evidence shows that the Messiah was expected to be a despised person from Galilee. No prophecy expected a Messiah from anywhere prestigious apart from Bethlehem. And third, Holding's conjecture assumes the Christians were eager to lie, which assumes too much, since his entire case depends on the premise that the Christians only told the truth, or at least told enough truth for him to rely on their records for making his case. It may be that Holding's point still carries weight against those who argue Jesus is a fiction. One might dispute even that, but I see no need to here. It might be true that in such a case a better place of origin would have been contrived for him. After all, once we grant that the Christians were fabricating, then we could presume that an origin at Nazareth might not have occurred to them, though an origin in Galilee would, according to Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 2. But Holding must suppose the Christians told the truth about his origins, so the prospect of inventing a better one is excluded for him. And for a real hero, his story, true or not, would far outweigh in its persuasiveness any trifle over where he came from, as it did for John the Baptist and Rabbi Eliezer. We have already seen from the evidence earlier that had Jesus really come from a small town in a lesser county of Judea, telling the truth about that would not have impeded the Christian mission at all, at least among those who would readily sympathize with the rural and middle-class roots of this hero of the masses. To be snobbish about where you came from or what you did for a living was indeed the very kind of thing the Christians despised about the social system they found themselves in, and the very thing they were seeking to escape by creating their own community where all would be equal. This was their intended audience, and for them, a Nazarene hero, indeed a hard-working carpenter who didn't live off the backs of others, would not be a difficult sell. Why a virgin birth? Finally, almost as an afterthought, Holding raises the issue of Jesus' parentage, asking, quote, how hard would it have been to take an adoptionist Christology and give Jesus an indisputably honorable birth, end quote, instead of making the harder to sustain claim that he was fathered by God. Of course, many Christians did exactly that is, preached some form of adoptionism. Indeed, it's not clear that Paul preached anything to the contrary, and he certainly makes no mention of anything but an ordinary birth into the Davidic line. So it cannot be said that Christianity's initial success had to be despite a claim to virgin birth. The jury is still out on when that idea entered the tradition. But Holding's question can be reframed as, why would later Christians, like the author of Luke, add to the package something that would be harder to sell? One reason is that an incarnated God was actually easier to sell to Gentiles than the more difficult idea of an anointed who was Son of God only in a particular esoteric sense, intelligible mainly to Jews. I'll address that issue in chapter 9. But presuming the Christians wanted to believe, and hence to preach, that Christ was both a man and a God incarnate, there is no other way the story could have sold except by positing a virgin birth to an unmarried woman. And thus, the need for these circumstances nullifies any difficulty this idea would pose to persuading mockers. This is because Jesus could only have been God incarnate if he was not fathered by a human being, while his divine patrimony could only be defended if his mother was, by law, a virgin when she conceived. Besides those requirements, to be the firstborn son was the most socially admired, and a virgin conceiving is both a miraculous testimony to his divinity and the best way to gain the Christians the rhetorical advantage of prophetic confirmation. Thus we find an explicit reference to the prophecy of his virgin birth as evidence Jesus was the Christ in Matthew 1, verse 23, and also in Justin Martyr, who reports the pagans already believed Perseus was born of a virgin, and thus were clearly open to the idea. Obviously, the more miraculous his birth, the more persuasive a hero's claim to divinity, as we know from many cases. Though, as with all the scriptural passages the Christians used to persuade people Jesus was the Christ, Jewish opponents could claim they were interpreting them incorrectly. But this was a problem faced by every sect of Judaism. The central issue in their debates was always the interpretation of contended passages in scripture, leaving victory to whomever was the more persuasive, which differed depending on their audience. Which is why Judaism hadn't unified itself on how to interpret scripture. Different views always had their loyal adherents. The Christians simply found theirs. Although the whole idea of the virgin birth would, as Holding suspects, add ammunition to Christian enemies, it would at the same time add appeal to those groups who were more sympathetic to the idea of a divine man than a mere chosen one. The overall effect would be a net increase in the popularity of the cult, since more people would be impressed by a miraculously born God-man than by accusations of absurdity or illegitimacy, while those who were quicker to believe the more cynical accusations were often the very people who would never have converted anyway. Even apart from the logical motive to make Jesus virgin-born, there could have been a historical necessity for the doctrine, at least for those who wanted or needed to believe Jesus was literally the Son of God. If Mary really was betrothed to Joseph when she conceived, and Jesus really was her firstborn, then she had to be a virgin, and therefore Jesus had to be virgin-born. For unless Christians were going to lie, they had to argue that Mary's first child was not produced by a sexual union, since sexless conception was the only way Jesus could be fathered by God. And since Mary was a virgin when she married Joseph, according to Luke 1, verse 27, and in any case, if she was not a virgin, unless she was a widow or divorcee, she would have been executed for the crime of fornication per Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 to 21, Jesus therefore had to be virgin-born. In his attempt at a rebuttal to this, Holding seemed to think I was referring here to the doctrine of immaculate conception, that Christ was thus not tainted by original sin, simply because I argue that Jesus had to be virgin-born to be divine. Holding must be confused. The Immaculate Conception was a late Christian doctrine about the birth of Mary, not Jesus. It was Mary who was born without sin, so no sin would be passed on to Jesus. In other words, the virgin birth was not the Christian solution to the inheritance of sin. The Immaculate Birth of Mary was. Therefore, the fact that this concept came late has no bearing on the motives for having Jesus born to a virgin, which required no concern for the problem of inherited sin. And I made no mention of this problem as the reason for making Jesus virgin-born. Rather, I am arguing God could not have sex, least of all with someone else's wife, because God could not sin. And that's certainly true. This was not a late notion, but certainly a fact of the Jewish faith at the time of Jesus. Therefore, only a non-sexual conception was ideologically possible. That leaves the option of whom to magically impregnate, and there were many good reasons to prefer it to be a virgin. So the only marketable way Jesus could have been the literal Son of God is if Mary was a virgin when she conceived him. And since